welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Tom Larimer, and he'll be answering your most important questions on the Deschutes River, rainbows, and steelhead. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. While you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Tom Larimer about the Deschutes River, rainbows, and steelhead. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects and by doing so give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Tom, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. In our drawing, we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Tom's section that says click here to register for the free drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And you can find out more about Front Range Anglers at www.frontrangeanglers.com. And if you win this, you can redeem it either on their online store or in their retail storefront as well. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be something we talked about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage with the correct answer. And the first person doing that will win the prize, $20 gift certificate. So listen closely, take notes, and we'll see you at the end of the show and see if you win. Tonight our guest is Tom Larimer. Tom guides clients into multiple steelhead during the highest sun of the day on the Deschutes, typically while other fly fishing guides are digesting lunch and waiting for shaded water. And it becomes apparent Tom's a traditional steelheader with little use for convention's impracticalities. His no-nonsense approach has found considerable respect among the folks at Airflow Fly Lines, Sims Hatch, and Solitude Fly Company, companies to whom Tom's input holds profound influence. Tom's flies are designed to make fish eat. The spay lines he has designed for Airflow make casting these flies effortless. Above all, the fact that Tom is one of the few jet boat guides in the history of the Deschutes to offer fly fishing-only trips originating from Heritage Landing seems to further his unconventional notion. While steelhead capture Tom's passion for a good part of the season, his obsession with chasing trout is obvious from the moment you step into his boat. The fact he has five different golden stonefly patterns, all designed for specific fishing situations, gives a bright insight to a brain that is completely saturated with the sport. After 17 years of guiding in the Great Lakes, Alaska, and Oregon, Tom has settled in Hood River, Oregon. He works summers and falls in his camp on the Deschutes and then moves to Clackamas come winter. Outside of angling, Tom is one of the most revered spay casting instructors in the world. Additionally, he hosts trips to some truly amazing fly fishing destinations. In the rare case he's not booked, Tom's probably fishing, just as any true addict would be. Tom, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
Well, good to have you on board here.
That sounded pretty good.
Pardon? That sounded pretty good? Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't read my bio in a while.
All right. We've tooted your horn enough, Tom. We don't need to toot anymore.
Yeah. Get down to business.
We're going to check out and see if you know anything about fishing here in a few minutes, and then we'll verify all your knowledge here.
The jury's out.
Yeah, there you go. So we've got lots of questions, lots of ground to cover. This is a river I've been wanting to do a show on for a long time because, you know, it's gotten such notoriety, and both for fishing and for whitewater rafting and so forth. It's quite a famous river, so I thought it'd be fun to do a show. And after talking to you, it's a river that is known for not only its steelhead, but also for its rainbow trout. So we're going to try to cover both those bases tonight and also give the folks here a tour of the river and give them a better understanding of that. So let's just dive right in here. We do have an international audience, and they all travel all over the world to do fishing. So why don't we first kind of give them a geography lesson on where the Deschutes River is, like, you know, where it starts, where it ends, and so forth.
Yeah, sure. The Deschutes is in north central Oregon. It starts in a place called Little Lava Lake, which is a spring lake up in the Cascades. If you're familiar with Oregon, it's south of Bend in the Sun River area. And the river actually starts off going to the south of a Little Lava Lake and then makes a U-turn. And then it heads towards the north, and the entire drainage is about 150 miles long, and it ends up ultimately emptying into the Columbia River about 12 miles to the east of the Dalles, Oregon, roughly about an hour and a half drive from Portland.
Okay, and the mighty Columbia. So the steelhead come up the Columbia and then go into the Deschutes, then?
Exactly, yeah. It's primarily a summer run steelhead river. We don't have a winter component in that river. It's just too far from the ocean. There's no doubt that fish that will come into the river through, you know, later in the season, like December and January, but it truly is a summer steelhead fishery.
And is the Columbia free of dams up to the Deschutes?
It is not. There's two dams. There's the Dalles Dam and the Bonneville Dam downstream of the mouth of the Deschutes.
So that must have some effect, too.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, I think that you can watch the migration of fish through the counts at the dams that you can see online. And because of the dams, you know, the Columbia doesn't move as fast as it once did, and it's a lot warmer. So that tends to slow the fish down probably considerably slower than what they did historically, you know, before the dams. So, yeah, they definitely have an effect on the Deschutes, but you know, one of the interesting things that has happened in the past is that because the Columbia runs warmer due to the dams, the Deschutes has always been a river that has attracted a lot of stray fish that will enter the Deschutes because the Deschutes is running colder than the Columbia. So that lower, you know, really that lower 12 miles is where you see these stray fish in mass come up. And you can have fish coming from the Snake River, the Grand Ron River, the Wenatchee River, the Clearwater, you know, all those upriver drainages, those fish will poke their head into the Deschutes in that July, August, early September time period to get out of the warmer water of the Columbia. Even though environmentally having the dams isn't really the best thing for us, it does help inflate the numbers of fish in the lower river because of that.
Okay. Now, the Deschutes itself, is it naturally segmented in? Before I go any further, just in case folks are on their computer, let me point them to where we found some pretty nice maps of the river. Folks, if you go to Boater Pass, like B-O-A-T-E-R, pass.com, it's Oregon State Parks site, and boaterpass.com, go there, and on the top line menu, you'll see the river. You click on that, and on the left side, you'll see links to individual map sections if you want detail or the map overview. And so Tom may be referring to some of these locations. That might be helpful to kind of follow along with us there. So Tom, is there some natural segmentation to the river, you know, falls, other things, or is it are dams involved in segmenting the river?
Yeah, well, there's four dams on the river that create reservoirs. And the furthest downstream reservoirs, like Billy Chinook, which is created by Round Butte Dam, and just below that is what's called Pelton Dam. So Pelton Dam is the furthest upstream migration point of steelhead at this point. So the section that we're really talking about today is going to be from Pelton Dam down to the mouth of the river at the Columbia. Although there are fisheries above that, it's such an immense fishery. Where I spend most of my time is really in that lower river, and more specifically in the lower 50 miles of the river is where I spend the majority of my time. But back to your question about being segmented, there is one fairly major waterfall on the lower 100 miles of river. It's called Shears Falls, and it's a really cool place to go check out. You can drive up right next to it. There is tribal fishing there. It's an immense, it's not that tall of a falls, but you see the entire Deschutes, which it's a big river. I mean, the Deschutes is 150, 200 feet wide in places, or even wider in some. And the whole river narrows down to a slot that you could make a roll cast across with a three-way. And then it just bowls through this really, really intense volcanic features, and it goes through Shears Falls, which is not passable by boat. It's actually illegal. It's a class 5. But it's cool to go check that out, and they have actually, there is a fish ladder there, and you can see the fish going over it, and it's just a neat place to go check out.
So as far as, and then from there, is it clear up to the dam?
There's some pretty major whitewater in actually the entire river. As far as kind of the notorious rapids, there's a section, for those of you looking at the map, you'll be able to see this, but there's a section between where Trout Creek is and Muffin, and it's called White Horse Rapids. And White Horse it's a scary piece of whitewater. I mean, it doesn't matter how experienced you are. If you hit that rapid, there's a rock at the top that I won't talk about the name because we probably can't say it here, but let's just call it Old Crap Rock. Can we see that?
Yeah.
But that rapids is notorious for sinking drift boats, and, even if you're an experienced whitewater, in rafts or in drift boats, you really have to know what you're doing in White Horse Rapids. There's along that upper section, let's just say from the Warm Springs boat ramp, which is really the furthest upriver boat ramp you can put in, down to the Muffin area. That's the biggest piece of whitewater in there. There's some other, nice class 2s, and I don't know if there's even any class 3s in there, but White Horse is the one that really demands the most attention. And then if you sort of break that into the next segment, which is what I consider the Muffin area, and that runs from Nina Creek Boat Ramp, and then you go all the way down to the town of Muffin, and then from Muffin down to a place called Max Canyon. Within that stretch, there's a number of big rapids, and there's this segment where Shears Falls is that nobody goes through. So in the lower river from Max Canyon, which is kind of the end of the Muffin stretch down to the mouth, there's 5 more big rapids. So the Deschutes is not a place that you just, necessarily go put your boat in and go for a nice float if you don't know where you're going or what you're doing. So I stress to people that want to come check out the river, either A, hire a guide first, or just do your homework. And the Bureau of Land Management, Oregon State Parks have done a really good job at, putting a lot of information out there. We talked about, they have a boater guide that actually talks about all of these different segments and then the rapids that are within them, the classification, and I believe that even has some suggestions as to how to run it. But, with all of that said, there are some segments that don't have major rapids that you can do day trips on that, if you're a solid oarsman and you feel comfortable rowing like a class 2 rapid, there's some good places to do that. Specifically, I'll just tell you a couple of floats for people to go check out. From Nina Creek, the water from Nina Creek, which is just upstream from Muffin about 10 miles. Muffin, by the way, is 50 miles up. That's kind of the only city right on the river. It's a very small town. So from Nina Creek down to Wapanisha is about a 3.5-4 mile float. And that's a really nice day trip with, there's minimal white water in there. I think there's like one very small class two.
You there?
Beaver tail?
Oh, you cut out on us totally.
Nope. You still got me?
Yeah.
How long was I gone for?
About 5 seconds or so. You were talking about going from Nina to Wapanita.
Wapanita, yeah.
And why don't you go over that again?
Let's go over that again. Nina Creek to Wapanisha Rapids, just above Wapanisha, there's a takeout. That's a really nice short day float with minimal white water. And then another two good floats would be from Pine Tree down to Beaver Tail, which is about an 8 mile float or so, and then Beaver Tail to Max Canyon. And within those three floats, there's not a whole lot of white water. Going upriver from that, another really nice day float with minimal white water would be to put in at the Warm Springs boat ramp and to take out at the Trout Creek boat ramp. So there is water where you don't have to go through these big rapids, but any other stretches on the river, you know, you need to be prepared to run some pretty serious white water.
Yeah, I noticed on the maps there that I directed people to, there's a big warning, Shears Falls, danger, not boatable. And then a lot of those other rapids you talked about, it says scout, which, of course, any boater knows that those rapids can change from day to day. So,
you know, one of the nice things about the Deschutes, Roger, is that because most of the rock is basalt, it doesn't move around much. Like some of the other rivers that I guide on, they can change. You have a big water event, and they can change dramatically overnight.
Yeah.
So the nice thing about the Deschutes is once you learn how to run a piece of white water, it's usually not going to change much unless there was, you know, some huge 100-year event.
Yeah.
With that said, this is kind of interesting. So in the lower river, there's a place called Washout Rapids. And Washout happened, I was actually sleeping in a tent in Hood River. I think I was about 20 years old. I was living in my car or sleeping in a tent all summer so I could just fish every day. And I remember we had this night where it just poured rain. I mean, it was just coming down. And the next day we had heard that there was a new rapids on the Deschutes. And sure enough, one of the canyons had blown out and created a class 5 rapids. You know, just a bunch of rock had fallen into the river, and overnight there was a major rapid. So
right.
Fortunately, I think that was in 1994. That's around the right time. There was a huge flood in 96, and, you know, the average river flows for the Deschutes are probably, you know, in the wintertime, high flows would be about 10,000. In the spring and the summer, you know, it'll start to drop, and we'll get down to, like, 4,500 CFS. Now, this is the gauge at the lower end of the river, so, you know, that's the biggest that it'll be. Well, this flood was, like, 50,000 CFS.
Right.
And it really mellowed out that rapids, and now it's just a good, solid class 3. But the fact that just overnight you had this massive rapids happen was...
They had a situation like that in Colorado. This is probably late 60s, I think, but it's on the Yampa River where same kind of thing, you know, overnight a rock the size of a house, you know, fell in off a cliff into the middle of the river. And the next commercial trip, rafting trip that went down, lost two people because of that, because they weren't expecting. It was not a big rapid before that, and when they hit it, they lost two people, and they weren't prepared. So, yeah, you never know.
Yeah.
You never know.
You never know on these big rivers.
Yeah.
That's what makes them pretty special, too. But, you know, back to my point, the nice thing about it is that, you know, for the most part, you learn these rapids, you scout them, you know, you practice good, safe boating technique, and you're going to be just fine.
And Ron Price in Pennsylvania wrote in, and he said, is there good access for wading fishermen?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, starting from, let's just start from the mouth of the river where it meets the Columbia and then move our way upriver.
Okay.
One of the interesting things is that the first 3 miles of the rapid, so from where it meets the Columbia upriver to a place called Rattlesnake Rapids, jet boats, drift boats, rafts cannot fish that water. We have to go float through it. And it's reserved exclusively for people who want to walk in. And so on the east side of the river, there is an old roadbed. Well, it's actually an old railroad bed that's follows the river, and you can go as far as you want. You cannot use motorized vehicles on it, but you can use a bicycle. And so a lot of people will bike up from the mouth, especially during the steelhead season. That's really popular. There's also a good walking trail on the west side of the river, and again, depending on how far you want to go. But that side's a little rougher to walk, so the east side seems to be, you know, kind of the easy. In fact, a lot of people will, they'll take a bike and they'll get one of those little kid carts, you know, that you haul your kid around in. They'll throw their fishing gear in there. They'll, you know, ride up the, it's basically an access road now, and, you know, and just fish. They'll usually ride up and then fish their way down. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a neat area where you're not going to have to contend with boats whatsoever. It does get somewhat crowded during the peak season, but there's always a lot of water. And then in the Maupin area, so 50 miles up is Maupin, you've got essentially 26 miles of road that goes down to Max Canyon and about 9 miles, I think it is, or 10 miles that goes north to Nina Creek. And that area is almost 100%. There's a couple little tiny spots where there's private land, but I would say 99% of it is all public access where the road follows the river and they have pull-offs, and it's a great area. This was the same area I was talking about doing day floats in. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of good access, and you can stay up in Maupin, which is, you know, a nice place. There's some good lodging up there. The Imperial River Company is one of my favorite places. I have most of my clients stay up there when I'm guiding in that area. So you've got, you know, restaurants and bars and places to stay and lots of good road access in that whole, you know, somewhere near 35 miles of river.
Good.
And then if you continue upriver, you know, from basically from Nina Creek, just upriver from that, there's a place called the Lock Gate. And that is kind of the end of the public access driving. However, you can continue up that road on foot all the way up to a place called the Deschutes Club where there's some private property up there, but you can access a bunch more water on foot above the Lock Gate. And you can see that on the map that we've been kind of referencing.
Yeah, you're tracking on that very nicely. Tom, we got to take a quick break. So let's hold your thought, and we'll come right back here in just about 30 seconds, okay? Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will reintroduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tom Larimer about the Deschutes River. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Tom, before we jump back into the questions, just wanted to ask you what's going on in your fly fishing world. Tell us a little bit about your business and what you do for people out there.
Well, I've got my paws in a lot of honeypots, Roger. guiding is obviously a big part of what I do. You know, I really spend most of my time on the Deschutes, especially, you know, the spring, summer, and fall. That's the mainstay of my business, doing both trout and then steelhead later in the season. And then in the wintertime, I'm just kind of getting into my winter steelhead season where I do the Clackamas River, the Sandy River, and the Hood River. But, you know, honestly, winter steelhead fishing is such a different game. You know, you have up and down water, you know, water levels and lots of storms in this area. So, you know, I don't get nearly as many days in the wintertime as I do in the summer and the fall. But outside of guiding, I do a number of things. You know, I teach spey casting instruction. I've had the really great privilege of working with Tim Ray Jeff at Airflow Fly Lines, and I've been able to design 4 or 5 different fly lines, all spey lines, for them, and that's actually, you know, part of what I do, and I'm on staff with them, and it's really fun being part of the, you know, kind of part of the think tank, which is, I think, help people, you know, we've developed gear that has helped people catch more fish, and that's been really fun. So in addition to that, I host travel trips to, you know, some really great destinations in British Columbia, Alaska, and the Bahamas. And that's a part of my business that I'm expanding, as well as doing clinics throughout the country on spay casting through fly shops. And this year I'm actually going to be, I thought this was funny, I'm going to be spending 4 or 5 days doing spay casting clinics in Fairbanks, Alaska, of all places. So apparently they have a huge interest in spay casting up there. So it's really fun. You know, I get to travel some great places, meet some great folks, and obviously I get to go fishing once in a while at those places too.
Yeah, that's terrific. That's terrific. And what's your website, Tom, where people can find you?
My website is www.larimeroutfitters.com.
LarimerOutfitters.com. LarimerOutfitters.com. Okay. Tom, I'm going to ask you, and I'm hearing this too, that we're getting a little breakup in your voice. I don't know if people are hearing breakup in mine as well, but can I ask you to hang up and dial back in on that second number, the 703 number that you have on your cheat sheet?
Certainly. Give me one sec. Let me make sure I have it. 703, got it. Yep. I will give you a ring.
Yeah. Just come right back in, same code and everything, and I'll be waiting here for you. So,
sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks, Robert.
So, folks, someone had written in that you're hearing a little garbled, and I'm hearing that too. Are you also hearing it in my voice, or is it just Tom's? If somebody could write in and let me know if mine's clear and it's just his. We'll see if this switching to a different line helps. Just Tom. Okay. Okay. Interesting. All right, we'll see what this new line that helps us out when he comes back here. So winter has finally arrived here in Colorado, folks. I'm up about 8,800 feet, but we got our first snow, real good snowfall today of about 6 inches here. So we've been waiting a long time where I live to get some decent moisture, which we need so badly because last year was not a good year. So for skiing or for water for fishing either, but at least we're starting to get some weather in now, which we like and we hope for. So good. All right, takes a bit to get that all dialed in and get back on here, but we'll have him back here in just a second. And then we'll
I'm actually back, Roger.
Okay, there we go. Okay, we'll give this
a
try,
better.
Tom, and see if it's flying or what, but we'll go from there. So let's pick up where we left off around the... We had a couple of questions here, and let me just run through these about the river itself before we start getting into talking about steelhead here. Let's see... Rick Smith wants to know, best trout fishing locations near Redmond or Klein Falls Road. Not sure where that is on the map, but...
Yeah, actually, and I don't know where Klein Falls Road is myself. That area is I don't guide that area. I actually did guide a little bit on the Warm Springs Reservation at one point, so I fished that section of the river, but, you know, kind of, this is good because it sort of finishes off the thought we had before about, you know, good places to wade the river.
Oh, yeah.
There's good access at Trout Creek, Mecca Flats, Warm Springs Boat Ramp where you can, you know, walk the river. And that's, you know, that's really the closest area to Redmond. I would say, you know, the Warm Springs area and Mecca Flat would be the two closest places to Redmond.
Okay. Okay. Now, I noticed on the map there we have Indian Reservation on the west side of the river there. What do we need to be concerned about as far as water rights? Can you wade? Can you go to the other side?
You know, so the reservation goes from, there's a small town at River Mile 65 called Dant, which is accessed only by a private road, or there's a few people grandfathered in that can use a boat to get there. But there's no fishing on the west side of the river from River Mile 65 all the way upstream to the dam.
Okay.
Now, there are places where there's a place where you can get a permit earlier in the season that goes from, like, Warm Springs down to a place called Rock Creek, I think it's called, which is right around Trout Creek. And you can buy a permit to fish on that side. But, you know, I'll be honest, I've seen many, many people poach that side, and they're just asking to get in trouble because, you know, we should respect the Warm Spring Indians and their land. It's awfully tempting because I can tell you from my experience guiding over there, the fishing is really good. But with that said, you just want to be respectful of them.
Now, if you're floating, I assume you can fish the whole river. You just can't anchor or wade on the west side. Is that it? Or
Well, you know, it's interesting, and this is kind of answers one of the questions down on the sheet that we have here, is that on the Deschutes, you cannot fish from a boat. And
anywhere.
Anywhere, yeah. So it's pretty unique. You can only use watercraft for transportation. So, you know, you'll see lots of drift boats and lots of rafts and jet boats in the lower river. Jet boats are only allowed up to a certain spot, to a place called Max Canyon, 23 miles up from the mouth. So with that said, you know, that section tends to get fairly busy on the east side of the river unless you have that permit to fish on the west side. But it is one of the kind of the disadvantages of floating in that kind of what I consider the upper section, that you can't really fish that west side of the river. So,
okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Good to know. So that's in answer to the earlier question about waiting, you're going to be doing a lot of waiting on the Deschutes.
You're going to be doing a lot of waiting. And, you know, one thing I should say about the wade fishing on the Deschutes, the Deschutes is a big river. It's really a fast, pushy river, and it has a lot of big rock. And, you know, we get used to it. Obviously, you know, we're out there all the time fishing it. And I remember moving out here. I'm the Midwest originally, and when I saw this place, it overwhelmed me. It was huge, and the wading was really hard. But, you know, the thing that I will tell people is that most of the time, if you're having a hard time wading, you're wading too deep, and that goes for both steelhead and for trout. So you want to be careful out there. You know, my clients, most of them wear some kind of or they have a wading staff, and a lot of them are wearing some kind of, you know, inflatable, you know, like those SOS suspenders, something that if they were to get in trouble, it's a great idea if you're if you're not a strong swimmer, or maybe you're, you know, a little bit older and not quite as steady as you used to be wade fishing. Those are two things you would definitely want to have when you come here.
Yeah, good tip. Brian Lee Summit, Missouri, he asked, do the steelhead run stop at Lake Billy Chinook Dam, or are there fish ladders in place to aid their journeys?
They do stop. They're trying to reintroduce salmon and steelhead in the upper basin right now. And this was actually a question that Paul Huffman asked us as well. He asked about the water temperature management. And
right.
This kind of goes along with this question.
Okay.
So essentially what has happened is, in order to relicense that dam, they needed to do two things. One was they needed to restore the water temperatures below the dam to pre-dam conditions. And then number two, they had to get successful spawning in the upper basin. So what they did is they built this tower that the number I have heard is $180 million they spent on this massive tower that allows them to extrapolate cold water from the bottom of the reservoir, and then they can collect smolts from above. And the problem is that the fish ladder going up worked just fine. They actually had this trolley system that they would get the fish over the dam. The problem with it was that if you look at a map of Lake Billy Chinook, you have the Crooked River comes in, the Middle Deschutes comes in, and the Metolius River comes in. And it's almost like a big Y if you think about the reservoir as a Y and the dam is at the bottom of the Y. Well, there was a huge back eddy in front of the dam now. So the smolts coming out of these different, you know, tributaries, and there's a couple other smaller tributaries that were, you know, actually pretty essential to summer steelhead in the basin. Well, all of this water would mix, and the smolts couldn't find their way to the fish passage. So what this tower is supposed to do is to be able to collect, it's essentially like an artificial river mouth. It's out in front of the dam. This thing sits in 250 feet of water. And I've toured it. It's pretty amazing. So with that said, there's the controversy behind this is that, you know, in the past, we would have water temperatures in July that would, say, be 55 degrees. And then through the summer, you know, by the time we hit, you know, kind of mid to late August, we would hit some pretty high water temperatures. You know, it might peak out at 70, 71 degrees in the afternoon, and it would go down overnight to, like, 65 degrees. And then, of course, through the fall, as the weather cooled off, so would the water. Well, this apparently does not follow what the historical water temperatures on the river were. So what they are doing is they're extrapolating warmer water out of the reservoir with this tower, dumping it down the river, and in July now we have these warmer water temperatures in the mid-60s to high 70s. And so by the time the kind of the late summer comes around, they have enough cold water stored up in the reservoir that they can push cold water down and, you know, avoid getting hot water temperatures later in the season. The controversy with this is it seems to me, I'm not a biologist, but I have been kind of the voice for fly fishermen in the lower river at the meetings with the biologists. It seems to me like we just traded hot water in August for hot water in July. And it has affected how our run timing is, because in the past, you know, we'd get steelhead in early July. Well, now the water temperature is a lot warmer than it typically was. And what we're finding is the Deschutes at times is running warmer than the Columbia.
Mm.
So the fish aren't coming out of the Columbia. Remember how I was talking about earlier, we have these stray fish that would come in.
Right.
Well, we're starting to, you know, we're not getting these stray fish. I mean, this product is only 2 years old. So, you know, we're still kind of learning how it's going to affect our fishery. With all of that said, what the biologists are telling me is that, you know, we should get more biomass in the system. And this is going to allow for spawning, you know, above the dam. So at some point, we may have, you know, established runs in these upper river, you know, these rivers above the dam. But I asked the biologist when I took a tour last year, I said, well, you know, under optimal conditions, you know, what can we expect for numbers of fish from this project? You know, how is this really going to increase the numbers of fish? And the answer was 1,000 spring Chinook, 200 summer steelhead, and then they're trying to get sockeye salmon back into the system, and that could yield anywhere from, you know, 20,000 to 250,000. They don't really know yet. So there's a lot of controversy with this as to whether or not it's going to actually help our runs or hurt our runs.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we've tried to kind of, you know, be a part of this as river stewards, I mean, I'm very involved with the river, as are most of my friends that are guides. You know, it just doesn't seem like they really listen to what we're saying. And we've seen some negative effects from it. But,
yeah,
you know, they keep telling us that it's going to ultimately be good for the river, and I just hope that they're right. But
yeah,
at this point, there are no...
We had a question come in on the Internet from Treg in Moscow, Idaho, and he says, and you may have just answered this, he says, has the temps changed? I don't believe we are getting as many strays in the summer now. So is this what you were just talking about, the July
factor? Exactly. And we're still getting some strays. It's probably not going to be what we saw in past years, especially in July and August. And we do get what people refer to as a bee run. It essentially, the bee runs are fish that are going to Idaho's Clearwater, and these are huge steelhead. They're two salt summer steelhead, but they spend 2 years in the freshwater. So they can reach some pretty immense sizes. And the biggest one that I've ever seen, a good client of mine named Jim Trainer landed, and it was 42 and a half inches. And with the girth, I forget what the girth, but it was about a 28, 29-pound steelhead. So those guys typically show up later in the season at any rate. So we're still seeing the B runs come in. We're not getting as many of the A runs, the smaller one-salt fish, that we would see those stray fish coming in July and August.
We've got to take another break here, but before we do that, I got a couple questions came in on the Internet. One was for you to repeat your website address. Could you repeat that again?
Certainly. It is LarimerOutfitters.com.
And LarimerOutfitters.com. And your voice does seem to be coming through clear now, Tom, so that's good.
Oh, good.
And another question, where, what, and how long did you guide in the Great Lakes area?
Well, I grew up in Wisconsin, and I spent 6 years in the Great Lakes guiding. I spent a couple years in Wisconsin when I first started, and then I moved over to northwest Michigan, and I guided on the Pier Marquette, the Big Manistee, Bear Creek, that area in northwest Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great, great. Okay, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back, and then let's talk about some steelhead. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tom Larimer about the Deschutes River in Oregon. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Another comment that came in from Treg is talking about wading. He says, cleats are invaluable.
Yeah. That's a good point I didn't say.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah, don't show up with rubber soles and no cleats because you'll be getting a baptism in the Deschutes.
Yeah. Treg, also, he's very active on our show. He says, he wrote in too, he says, I used to be able to catch steelhead in August and September. Now it is much tougher. Is it just poor numbers? If you were going to do one float a year from max to the mouth in general, when would you go?
Well, I think it has gotten tougher. You know, I used to start my guide season on the 8th of July for steelhead. That's the point I'd always switch over. And last year I started on the 28th of July, and this year I'm going to be starting kind of in mid-August. And it
wow.
just seems like we don't have as many fish early in the, you know, system like we used to. And there's a few there. It's not that there's not, you know, fish there. I'm just not one of these guides that will take people for a boat ride. It's just not my style. If I don't feel like I can go out there and find fish consistently, I'm not going to go. And until I get a better idea of what's happening with these changes in the water, you know, I'm just not going to book trips. So it's not to say that there aren't fish there, but it certainly has gotten more difficult to catch those early fish. To answer the second part of the question, when is the best time? You know, that's a hard question because if you look at the, you know, when the biggest slug of fish comes up the Deschutes, it's no doubt, you know, late August, you know, through September. And, you know, of course, people always want to know when's the best time to go. Well, if your definition is when the most fish are in the river, that's the best time to go. But that's also when the most people are there. So, interesting enough, you know, there's a lot of times where I do better in kind of the fringe seasons because, quite simply, I can fish the water that I want to fish. Whereas, you know, when I'm in kind of what people consider the prime time, sort of mid-September, I don't always get to fish the really, you know, the quality runs that I like to fish. I'm more, you know, I'm fishing much smaller water at that point just because oftentimes there's people in the big runs. So if you don't like to see people, I like that October time frame and even into November, which the weather can get a little dicey. But after about the last, well, I'd say about the third week of October, there is almost nobody down in the lower river. So, you know, there's not going to be as many fish, but it's a little different experience than, you know, mid-September.
Yeah, okay. Now, I have to read this question because hopefully you can help fill out. Phil wrote in from Utah, but when I read this, I laughed, and then I realized what a bad day it was for him. But, it says, he says, do you know anyone that will do a shuttle from the falls to the mouth of the Columbia and be nice to my truck and trailer? He says, I went and did a three-day float, got to the parking lot, and had two flat tires. And the dust blew out of the AC vent for 20 minutes. So you got to laugh, but poor Phil, man, I'd be pissed off.
Poor Phil. Sure. Well, Phil's not alone. You know, there's a guy in Maupin that makes a living repairing tires. And unfortunately for him, they have now done a bunch of work on the access road that essentially where Phil put his boat in. He had to drive down this access road, and someone in their infinite wisdom decided to basically use crushed basalt for this gravel road. Well, basalt just tears apart tires, and, I mean, I would see people all the time on this road with multiple flat tires. So last summer they did a bunch of work. I think it's not all the way down to Max Canyon on that road, but it's really close to it. So the road has become a lot kinder since probably he did this. But with that said, I use Henry's Deli, which is in Maupin, to do all my day float, you know, my shuttles there. And he also does shuttles down to the mouth, and he's very reliable, and usually he takes care of my truck anyway.
Did you say Henry's Deli or Deli?
Deli, Henry's Deli. It's right before you cross the bridge in Maupin, and you can pretty much ask anybody in Maupin where Henry's is.
Okay.
It's not a big town.
Okay, good. Okay, well, we've got you covered there, Phil, so hopefully you'll have a better experience for next time for multiple reasons. But okay, let's talk about steelhead. Now, you primarily guide that lower section, you said, for steelhead, so I'm assuming there's a reason for that. Is that one of the better areas for steelhead?
It is. It is. It's, you know, you have in that lower 15 miles or so, it just seems like, you know, you've got the stray fish element. There's fantastic water to swing your fly in. And the fact that you're fishing over fish that are moving is really big. And by that, I mean, you know, as the fish move up the system, they start to slow down. And as they slow down, they become less aggressive. So from a steelhead perspective, I chose to put my operation in the lower rivers because of that. Now, that said, there's some great steelhead fishing all the way up, and it's you shouldn't be, you know, put off by the fact that there, you know, there might be a few more fish downriver. You can have some great fishing in that Maupin area, and that usually starts getting going by, you know, September. When I lived in Maupin for four seasons and guided up there, and, you know, I would always catch a fish up there by the 4th of July. So they get some early fish up there, but usually by about, you know, the beginning of September, you start to see more fish in Maupin, and then by, you know, kind of mid to late September is when they really start to get up into the, you know, Warm Springs area in mass. So you can have some great days up there. Just personally, I like the water down below, and it's the only stretch that I can use my jet boat on, and fishing out of the jet boat is just a great way to fish. It gives me a lot of flexibility, how I fish, where I fish, and when I fish. And so I think that lower river is the best spot for steelhead.
So explain to us how you, you know, most of us, you know, they used some jet boats up in Alaska to get us, you know, to transport us, and that worked out
sure.
Great. Explain to us what a day is like in a jet boat as far as steelhead fishing and what you guys do.
Yeah, well, you know, I do all camp trips nowadays. I used to do day trips, but I had so much demand to do overnight trips that I ended up just committing to doing these multi-day camp trips. So typically, you know, we'll pick our clients up at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, their first day, and we run up to camp, which we've already got set up, and you throw your stuff in your tents, we do a quick tour, and we hit the water. And what I like about it, I kind of mentioned this, you know, the jet boat gives me a lot of flexibility because if the river's crowded, I can go elsewhere. But I think more importantly, the thing that I've realized most about the Deschutes is that it's all about being in the right place at the right time. And from a floating line perspective, you know, fishing, you know, classic wet flies or classic dry flies in the surface film, you have to have shade. So I can run to a spot that I know is going to have shade 2 hours before the rest of the river. I can, you know, I can move with the shade as the sun moves, and that gives a huge advantage. So in the, either the morning or the evening, I'm always kind of thinking about, you know, where that sun's going to be and where I'm going to have light off the water. You know, once the sun gets on the water, in the past, it was really kind of thought that you could not catch fish during the middle of the day on the Deschutes. You know, the river runs from the south to the north, so the sun is shining directly into the fish's face. And what I've kind of figured out is that we can use the sun angles, even if it's somewhat in their face, as long as the fly isn't tracking directly into the sun. So in other words, as long as the fish doesn't turn and have to follow the fly directly into the sun, we can catch fish very consistently using sink tips and bigger flies during the middle of the day. So, you know, kind of my whole program is, you know, we fish the shade in the mornings. We're kind of bumping around trying to find that shade. But once the sun gets on the water, then we're looking for sun angles. So the jet boat allows me to kind of move around with those sun angles and keep my guys in water that is effective. You know, we're effectively fishing at that point. So we do typically take a break in the middle of the day just because the days can be fairly long. So we'll go back to camp and have some lunch and relax and usually head out in the afternoon and kind of repeat the whole process. It's all about chasing the light.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a very different approach because you don't have a lot of those options when you're drift boat fishing.
You don't. You can do it to an extent, and if you really know what you're doing, you know, you certainly know what time the sun gets off the water on certain runs, but the jet boat is, not to mention, it's just really fun. I mean, you go crashing up through these rapids. You know, I have a 200 horse. Well, I repowered my boat this year. I have a 200 horsepower on a 20-foot boat, and you just, you know, people always say to me
that. What you're saying, Tom, is you just like driving the boat.
I have to admit, man, the adrenaline junkie in me, I really like it. It's fun.
Anthony in Half Moon Bay, California, wrote in, and he says on the California coast he wants to fish for stripers, and so a lot of people there use 8, 9 weight, 11 foot rods for stripers, and he says, could you use this for steelhead? He wants to buy a very versatile rod, and you know, would that setup work for steelhead?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you'd have to have the right line, so you would use a different line for fishing stripers, but one of the fly lines that I designed, well, there's two lines that would work really well. You could put an airflow Skagit switch on an 11-foot 8 weight, and that would be a great rod for fishing sink tips in the middle of the day. You could put a pretty big sink tip on an 8 weight and a big fly. And then another line that I developed is called a Rage Compact. So what you would do is take your Skagit head off, which is your sink tip head. You have a running line that you connect this with. You take off your Skagit head, and you would put this Rage head on. And the Rage head was developed specifically for big western rivers like the Deschutes, where we have very little back casting room and a lot of wind. Because the Deschutes, I mean, we're right next to the Columbia Gorge, which gets a lot of wind, and fishing in the wind is not always there, but it's a part of our life. And so, you know, you use this head for your floating line stuff when the sun's off the water. So it's kind of a nice little system, and that rod would work just perfect for it.
Okay. And in general, would that be the setup you'd recommend? Or if you were just coming for steelhead, what would be the setup you'd recommend?
Well, you know, switch rods, which, you know, that 11-foot range are typically switch rods. I don't like to start beginners with switch rods. The window of opportunity to cast them well it's a smaller window than if you have like a 12.5-foot 6 weight or a 13-foot 7 weight. So I would say the average rod on the Deschutes is that, a 6 or a 7 weight in that, 12 foot up to about 13 feet. That seems to be what most people gravitate towards, but switch rods do work really well there, and even though it's a big river, most of the steelhead do not sit way out in the middle of the river, even though people like to cast really far. Have you ever tried spey casting, Roger?
Yeah, at the shows, but I've never actually fished spey casting.
Yeah. You know, you get out in the river and you start to realize that you can cast, as far as you really want. And I constantly have to tell people, bring it in. That's great. You can cast that far, but the fish are right there. So.
Yeah.
The spey rods, it's funny because people get this idea that you buy a spey rod so you can cast further. But really the big reasons why we fish them is the ability to cast with very little back casting room, which anybody who's ever fished the Deschutes, you realize that, you take a 9 or a 10-foot 7 weight out there and half the runs you fish, you're going to have alders, 5, 10 feet behind you. So it makes it very difficult with a single-hand rod. Not that you can't do it, but a two-hander makes that really easy, but I think more importantly, it's what happens once the fly hits the water. That longer rod gives you the ability to really control your fly and to control the speed of it, to control, the aspect of it, whether you want the fly to fish really broadside, which we do at certain times, or if we want the fish to come across, the fly to fish a little slower and kind of fish butt down. So the long rods give us a lot more control over what our fly does. And those are the two biggest things, back casting and control. But I also think, too, the wind, because we have wind, two-handed rods make it a lot easier for people to be able to make, if you can cast 50 feet clean on the Deschutes, you're going to catch a lot of steelhead. If you can go 65, that's perfect, and about 75 is kind of the max in about 90% of the spots. And, there are some spots where the 100-foot cast gets it done, but most of the time, 50, 60 feet, and you're in the ballgame.
Good. Thu Christensen from Denmark, I think we answered his question on the summer runs as to when the fish come in numbers. I think we covered that quite thoroughly now.
Mm-hmm.
He also asks, what's your go-to pattern in early summer steel? Well, you really don't have early summer steelhead, do you?
Yeah, I'll say this just to answer it. you know, a couple things for people to think about when they come to the Deschutes is that you should really base your fly selection on what the water temperatures are. And so early in the season now, when we have warmer water temperatures, we're fishing smaller flies. And there's usually not a, like, one go-to, this is the fly you fish on this river. But the Deschutes fish love purple and they love black. And they tend to like something with a hot butt. So, like, your classic green butt skunks, or I have a fly tied by Solitude flies that's called a low water purple green butt. You know, something that has a little bit of flash in it, but typically when that water is warm, you want to fish a fairly small fly, like a size 7 or a size, you know, even down to like a size 8, and I have gone as small as a size 10. As the water temperatures cool down, we typically bump our sizes up. So by, say, late October, we're fishing a lot of size, you know, 3s. And I'm really talking about the dry line game here as far as these flies that we're talking about. So in general, I would say I always have, if I had to choose one fly, I always have a purple green butt on one of my clients' rods because that seems to be really good. But, you know, I'm always surprised how, you know, if everybody's fishing a purple green butt or a green butt skunk and you throw a red fly out there, sometimes that gets the eat. So, you know, I try not to get into that magic fly syndrome, but, you know, we all do.
Okay.
On the flip side of that, when you're fishing sink tips, you know, typically our fish will eat fairly big flies, bigger than what most people think on the Deschutes. And I tend to fish a lot of flash in my flies, and they're not always on the flash, but more days than not, they like some flash in the fly when you're fishing sink tips. But when the water gets really warm, sometimes they just want a really natural black or even a brown leech. So, again, water temperature is going to kind of dictate what fly I end up tying on.
Okay, good. Duke in New York, and he has a number of questions here. Excuse me if I mute out here once in a while. I'm kind of getting over a cold, and I still got a little bit. Let's see. He says, I managed to catch a few fish swinging flies with my two-handed rod during spring, summer, and fall, but my winter success with the swung method is poor at best and dismal at worst. While I know that nymphing is probably going to get me into a few winter fish, I struggle to find the right place and depth for nymph fishing. Also, when steelhead run is not thick, nymphing only allows me to cover a tiny portion of the river. So he's got two questions for you. Can you help him understand what kind of water he should be targeting during winter fishing, both for steelhead and trout, and also if he wants to use the swung fly method, do you have any suggestions about how deep he should fish that and what kind of water you should target?
Yeah, yeah.
Long question.
So I sort of made, yeah, no, this is great, though. I mean, I kind of made reference to this in our last question about, you know, the water temperature. And
right.
And I will say that everything I do, Roger, is based on water temperature, whether it be the fly that I choose to fish, you know, how I'm going to try to fish it, and the water I choose to fish it in. So, you know, to answer his question, you know, I'm thinking about in colder water temperatures in the winter, I'm thinking about fishing my fly a little bit slower. And a lot of times I'd like to try to experiment. So if I'm not getting fish to eat my fly, if I'm fishing it really, really slow, even though the water's cold, I will try fishing it faster. I'll try different speeds. And, you know, I think sometimes steelhead fishermen, we get into this mentality that it's really just chuck it out there, put a mend into it, let it swing, step down, do it again. And if you do it long enough, God will intervene at some point and you will catch a fish.
Yeah. I've had that happen.
And, yeah, yeah. And it's funny because, I mean, I'd like a lot of different styles of fishing. I mean, fly fishing, spey casting for steelhead is by far, that's my passion. But something that a lot of people don't know about me is I love to fish for bass. And I would actually fish in tournaments when I was younger, and I still fish a lot of smallmouth on the Columbia. And if you talk to a guy who is really experienced, like I'm talking like tournament-level guys that fish crankbaits for bass, they are very specific about the cadence. In other words, how fast they're reeling that crankbait. Well, they're trying to get a reaction bite from those bass with the crankbait. Exactly what we're trying to do swinging our fly for steelhead. We're trying to get the fish to make a quick reaction and jump on this fly. So here are these guys fishing for one of the most aggressive fish out there, and they are so in tune with how fast their lure is moving. And yet, as steelhead fishermen, you know, we're fishing for a fish that ostensibly has no appetite, and yet we kind of just say, well, you chuck it out there, you mend it, you let it swing. You know, and these are the things that I really try to pay attention to is if I get a fish that eats the fly on a really slow swing, chances are there's a pattern developing, right? Or if I get a fish that eats the fly really, really fast, because the other side of that coin is in warmer water conditions, I think most people fish their fly way, way too slow. I want the fly moving very quickly when the water is warm. So my best advice to him is to, you know, try fishing the fly slower, and if you're not getting bit, try fishing it maybe just a little bit faster and see if something happens. But this also goes into the second part of his question as far as water goes. You know, typically the colder the water gets, the slower the water that you need to fish. Now, he's from New York, and Duke may be very well talking about fishing in the Great Lakes, and back there they get some really, really cold water temperatures, and I have fished, you know, fairly extensively back there, and I can tell you that the water that they fish in the wintertime, I mean, it can be, I mean, almost painfully slow to fish because those fish will slide into, I mean, almost dead standing water. I mean, there's just the faintest current that you can imagine. So, you know, look for slower water, fish your fly a little bit slower, and as far as depth goes, you know, I think sometimes we get into this idea that we have to fish the fly really, really, really deep. And, you know, what I always try to think about with steelhead is that, you know, there's going to be active fish and there's going to be non-active fish. There's going to be, you know, those fish sitting on the bottom with their fins out straight. Those fish are not going to chase a fly down that we're swinging across, trying to get them to get this reaction bite. We're looking for an active fish, and typically an active fish is going to be suspended off the bottom anywhere from about 10 to 15 inches. And, you know, when I used to guide in the Great Lakes, you could see a lot of fish out there. That's not the case where I guide. You could tell the ones that were going to eat and the ones that were not. The ones that were going to eat were almost always suspended, and they just kind of had this attitude about the way they swam. So if you think about, you know, let's say an average steelhead run is 4 feet deep and your fish is suspended 12 inches off the bottom, if you get your fly down 2.5 feet, you're right in that fish's dining room. And if you're snagging up constantly, you're probably fishing underneath the fish. So I always try to fish that fly in that kind of mid to lower water column. But if I'm snagging up all the time, then I end up, you know, going to a lighter sink tip and fishing the fly in a little bit higher in the water column.
Okay. Now, Duke also had some questions about asking about how you break down different sink tip and poly leaders in different conditions. You want to talk about that first?
That's a great question. So for those that don't know what a poly leader is, essentially what it is they make them in different lengths, anywhere from 5 to like 14 feet. Most people steelhead fishing are using 10-footers, I would say, on average. And these leaders have a taper to them, and they make them in different densities. So they really help you turn over the fly. And so they make them in floating, intermediate, all the way down to, you know, really fast sinking. And poly leader is great for a number of things. If you're fishing a smaller fly and you want to get it down, you could put a sinking poly leader on. I use them a lot on the Deschutes when we have wind. And we'll put just a really slow sinking poly leader on, nothing that's going to dredge the bottom, but just having that little extra density out there helps you cast through the wind. So it's a really good thing to have in your vest or in your pack is just a really light sinking poly leader. And then, you know, we use them on our dry lines as well. I use an intermediate poly leader almost exclusively. I even fish my dry flies on an intermediate poly leader because they really don't sink very fast. So poly leaders are great for that. The big mistake that people make is that they try to use a poly leader with a really heavy fly. And that doesn't work very well because the poly leader doesn't have enough diameter to it. So if you're going to throw a big fly, you know, especially something with some weight on it, that's where you want to use, you know, a regular sink tip, something that's, you know, T10 or T14, sort of the normal sink tips that we use for steelhead. So you're just going to get a lot more diameter out of those that'll help you turn over the fly.
Okay, great. Another question about gear. Ted from Guilford, Connecticut asks, he says, do West Coast steelheaders use center pin rods to float fish for steelies like they do up in the Salmon River in New York State? Or, says, here it seems like the best way to hook up on them. So can you talk about that, maybe explain what that is for folks that aren't knowledgeable about that?
Yeah, so a center pin is basically, if you imagine a flywheel that has a bearing system in it that allows your spool to spin freely for, I mean, if you spin one of these things, they're going to spin for 5 or 6 minutes straight. Very, very well-built reels. But, you know, there's some good ones and some bad ones out there, but the good ones are, I mean, it's just precision reels. And they have a kind of an opening between the frame and then the spool that allows the line to come off of that. Now, this is you're using monofilament, so make the distinction that this is not fly fishing. But they're fishing these on long float rods, you know, anywhere from 10.5 to 13, even up to like 15 feet. And they're using a float with some kind of a lot of guys will fish flies, some guys will fish bait below them. And you make a center pin cast. There's a lot of information on the internet. You can see it. And what's deadly about this technique is it allows you to get a dead drift all the way down, you know, a nice long seam, because as you cast that float out there, the reel is so smooth that the line just kind of peels off the reel. And there's an art to it. I think, you know, this kind of crossover that we're seeing with, you know, some fly guys that maybe want a little bit more of an advantage in the winter, or they just don't want to fly cast, you know, they end up center pinning. And it's not really big out here on the West Coast. There is a small growing number of people. But I've tried it. I've done it. To be honest with you, I got pretty bored doing it. But I also know guys that love doing it. You know, that's kind of what they do in the wintertime. So it is very effective, but it's not really fly fishing.
Okay. Jeff in Chilliwack, B.C. asks, do you weight your flies or rely on your sink tip to get them down?
I do both. I fish a lot of tube flies. And you know, there's just certain runs that fish really, really well with, you know, a weighted fly. And then, you know, there's places where it's just an unweighted fly is all you really need with your sink tips. So part of it is, for me, from a fishing standpoint, how each piece of water likes to fish. And, you know, inevitably, steelhead runs always have a secret. You know, that there's a way they like to be fished. It might be the wading line. It might be the, you know, how far you cast. It might be the river level, the time of the day, you know, whatever. But a lot of times it comes down to what sink tip you have on and is it a weighted fly or an unweighted fly. So my first part of the equation for me is how the run likes to be fished. But the second part from a guiding standpoint is that, you know, I feel like beginners and oftentimes even intermediates just fish better with an unweighted fly because the fly will turn over when they cast, whereas if you try to put on a really big, heavy, you know, fly that's not very fun to cast, then, you know, if their cast isn't going out there well, they're not going to catch very many fish. So, you know, it's a good tip for beginners. You're better off getting, you know, maybe fishing a little lighter with your fly and getting a good cast than trying to heave some big, heavy fly out there and not get a good cast, because you'll always catch more fish if your fly turns over nice and straight and starts fishing immediately.
Good. Well, you've provided a lot of good tips on steelhead fishing, and appreciate that, Tom. We're running out of time, but I wanted to talk about the rainbow trout in the river, too. So let's talk about that for the last few minutes so we don't ignore that, because there is some excellent trout fishing there.
Oh, yeah.
What's the season there for the trout, and what are we looking at there as far as size and, you know, average fish in the river?
Yeah. Well, you know, the cool thing about the lower Deschutes, you know, in the Maupin area and down below is it's open year-round. You can fish down there. And, you know, the Deschutes is really famous for our salmon fly hatch, which is typically starts in about middle of May, and then it works its way upriver, and by about the first week, second week of June, it usually starts to peter out. So, you know, you can catch fish year-round. I really love that time from about the salmon fly hatch on till about the middle of July or so. And that's when we have our biggest hatches. We have, you know, depending on where you're at in the river, there is a lot of different mayfly species. The green drake hatch, when it happens, can be amazing. We have great PMDs, pale evening duns, a variety of other, you know, blooming olives, a variety of other different mayflies. But by and large, this is a caddis river. And if you come here, you should have a lot of different caddis patterns. You know, Sylvie's, if you look at Brian Sylvie's collection of caddis flies, I really think they're some of the best. I have a couple different caddis patterns that are tied by by Solitude. So you definitely want to come armed with a lot of Caddis, you know, some Mayfly stuff. Midges can be a part of the game, especially in the wintertime. As far as the average fish goes, and I don't know if we talked about this, but there's only rainbows in the Deschutes, and they're all wild. So there's no stocking whatsoever, and they're a beautiful fish. They're known as red sides because they tend to get this very, very, you know, brilliant red hue to them, especially the males when they get older. They'll almost get like this purpley look to them. And one of the cool things, if you come here and fish, notice how big the eyes are on these fish. They have these just huge eyeballs, and I think they have very good sight. So the average in size, you know, I would say an average fish for us would be between 10 and 15 inches. You know, a big fish for us would be like at 16 to 18, and there's a few 8 or 19, 20, and even bigger out there. But I always laugh. You know, I used to walk in, used to work in a fly shop, and people would come in, and I'd ask them how the fishing was, and they'd say, "Well, you know, I caught like 5 20-inchers today." There's not that many 20-inchers in the Deschutes. It's not a big fish river. It's just not. But, you know, one of the things that I love about the Deschutes is that because the river is so big, these fish are the strongest rainbows pound for pound. I mean, I would put a 15-inch Deschutes River rainbow up against any other river, equal size and weight, and they would drown them. They would pull them backwards. They are the strongest fish. I mean, I've watched like 14-inchers put a guy to his arbor knot on a 5-weight before. So they're really, really fun fish to catch because I think the river is just so big that they make their living out there in that strong current, and they're just amazing fish. So they kind of, what they lack in overall size, they certainly make up for in heart.
What about up by the dam? Is that considered a tailwater fishery up there? Do you find
it is
fish
it,
more
it
like a tailwater up there? Okay.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's interesting. I mean, there's probably a question here where the best, you know, where is the best fishing for rainbows? You know, like any tailwater, you're going to have more fish the higher up in the system you go, the closer to the dam you get. And with that said, if you look at, you know, the fish counts per mile up by the dam, I think there's something like, you know, 2,000 fish per mile or something like that. And then as you work your way downstream, you have a lot less. So one of the things that I love about where I guide, you know, I do the salmon fly hatch up in the Maupin region because we don't have salmon flies in the lower part of the river. There's a tributary that comes off of Mount Hood called the White River, and it dumps a lot of silt into the river because it's a glacial stream. So we don't have huge populations of salmon flies down in that kind of that lower 20 miles. But what is really interesting about that lower 20 miles where I guide is that very, very few people fish down there. So it's one of those things. If you want more fish, you know, the closer to the dam you go, but if you like solitude, fishing in the, you know, lower down in the system, I mean, on average trout day for me, when I'm fishing out of my jet boat and I'm talking about, you know, launching at the mouth of the river and fishing that lower 15 miles or so, I don't see another person. I mean, I'm on the world-famous Deschutes River, and I don't see anybody else. And, you know, the thing about that is, you know, you can go upriver, and there's more fish, but they're getting pounded because there's, you know, 10 guide boats a day going down, where I can go into a spot, there may be half as many fish, but they have not been pounded to death. In fact, I rotate my spots. I don't fish the same spots intentionally so that I rest those fish. And, you know, I like solitude. I'm the kind of person I would much rather be on a river with a few less fish than, you know, have a ton of people around. So there's kind of an experience there for everybody, I guess.
Okay. One final question here we'll finish up with, because it was, you know, talked about in your bio, your introduction, and Jim Wright wrote in Crescent City, California. He says, "Tom, what are your favorite stonefly patterns and sizes throughout the year?" So it sounds like that's something dear to your heart, our stonefly patterns.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about 1 minute on that?
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever fished the stonefly hatch, or the, you know, we have golden stoneflies and we have the salmon flies here, you know, it's an amazing thing. I have a pattern that's tied by solitude. It's just called Larimer's Golden Stone, and that's a great fly. It's got a little bit of foam on it, but one thing that you'll notice about the Deschutes is that these fish typically don't like real big foam patterns. There are a few out there that work. The Chubby Chernobyl, which has kind of gained national recognition, it does work. I noticed last year, though, the fish started rolling on that fly more than they actually ate it. But these fish like the fly to sit low in the water column. So there's a real classic fly called the Norm Woods Special. Norm Woods was a longtime guide on the Deschutes. And it's very much like a stimulator, but it has a calf tail, kind of this peachy color calf tail wing on it. And the magic of that fly is that it sits really low in the water column, and the fish eat it really well. So my stonefly pattern was somewhat inspired by the Norm Woods Special because I liked how low it sat, but I noticed that clients had a hard time keeping it near the surface. And even though the fish will eat it once it goes below the surface, in fact, one of my stonefly patterns is a subsurface adult stonefly, which is not tied commercially. You got to keep some things close to your belt, right? The big thing to remember with the stoneflies there is that, you know, you don't want to use real big, high-riding foam patterns, something that's going to sit low in the film. In fact, I cut the hackle off of all of my, you know, like a stimulator-style fly. I cut all the hackle off. I want the fly to fish really, really low in the water column. And if I can give people one last piece of advice on the Deschutes is that, you know, if you see a fish, you know, they come up and they look at your stonefly and they don't eat it. The biggest mistake you can make is to throw that fly right back out there, and I see people do it all the time. These fish are way too smart for that. It's a challenging fishery because they're all wild, and they get pretty dang smart. So be observant. If you see a fish, he comes up and denies you, take that pattern off, throw something a little smaller, maybe a golden or a yellow Sally in front of them, and it's amazing how many of those fish will come back. But they typically, you know, they know if you put the same fly out there, they're just not going to eat it. So, you know, keep that in mind. It might help you catch a few more fish out there.
And one last thing, Treg, one of our listeners, wrote in. He says, don't forget to talk about the snakes. He says, we don't want everybody coming out there. So.
Yeah,
so we'll let them wonder about the snakes, okay?
Well, there are rattlesnakes. It's rattlesnake country, and if you take your wading staff and you bang it on the ground in front of you as you're walking, you won't usually see them. So they're part of the experience.
All righty. Well, unfortunately, it's time to wrap it up here, but we do have a few more things to cover before we end the night. So stick with me here, Tom. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and we'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. So stick with us here just a couple more minutes, and we'll do just that, give away those prizes. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's www.savebristolbay.org to learn more about what you can do to get involved. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. And now it's time to give away our prizes. So the winners of the drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for the show tonight, it's too late now, but do so for our next show so that you have a chance on winning some of these great prizes. Let's see. Hold on. I got to get my database going here. And a little technical difficulty here, folks. And now we are set to go. So the first prize we're going to give away here is that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you want to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And our winner for that is Charles Pigos. Charles Pigos. And Charles is in Ohio. So congratulations, Charles. And I know you'll enjoy that membership. If you already have one, we'll get it extended for you. So we will contact you by email when after the show's over. And now we're going to give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And great magazine out of Calgary, Canada, and always a great great magazine to read. And we've got a winner in Finland. How's that? Bruce Deschamps. And I'm just writing his name down. Bruce in Finland, congratulations. So that's a long way off. So that ought to match up because they've got a lot of, being in Canada, we've got a similar latitude there, and a lot of the techniques and things might work there in Finland as well. So congratulations. And now we're going to give away that $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers. And if you win this, you can redeem it, like I said, in their online store or in their brick-and-mortar store in Boulder, Colorado. So great place to go and hang out at Front Range Anglers. So let's see now. This question is going to be a little bit different. If you want to get a good shuttle along the Deschutes, where would you go to get a good shuttle so you don't end up with two flat tires and an air conditioning full of dust? Where would you go on the Deschutes? Treg, how can you be so fast, Treg? He says Henry's Deli. I thought that's where you get a sandwich, Tom. What's he talking about?
Treg is absolutely right. You can get a sandwich there, too.
Oh, okay, okay. While you're waiting for your flat tires to get fixed, right? No. Just kidding. All right, you win again, Treg. Treg wins a lot, but he's fast and he's sharp, and it sounds like he fishes that area a lot. So, Treg, I got your email address here. That's all I need, and we'll get that gift certificate out to you from Front Range Anglers. And come visit us in Colorado now. You got an excuse. So. Well, that's about it for tonight. Tom, thanks so much for being with us tonight and sharing your knowledge about the Deschutes. I sure learned a whole lot tonight, and sounds like a great place to come visit and do some fishing. So thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Well, hopefully, everybody, you've found our archive on our website. I want to just bring it to your attention again. You can find a link to it at the bottom of most of our pages or all of our pages. Go out there and do some searches. We've got over close to 160 shows now. And you can search by keyword phrase, location, type of fish, type of fishing, trout, tarpon, Deschutes River, and so forth, steelhead. And explore out there. You'll find a lot of shows you're going to like and a lot of shows you're going to learn from. So go out there and poke around, see what you can find. Our next broadcast will be on January 2nd at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And that show, we're going to have Norm Ziegler. And our topic for the show is going to be Snook on a Fly. Norm is an internationally known author and journalist, literally wrote the book on snook, called Snook on a Fly, and Norm has spent the last 18 years chasing and catching this elusive game fish. So listen in and hear Norm share his secrets on fly fishing for snook. We'd also like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Housatonic River Outfitters, Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.